A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been reading about Israel's formal program to hunt down every terrorist involved in the October 7th attacks, and he's got a question that cuts through the politics to something more operational. How do intelligence agencies keep working these very specific cold cases years after the event has faded from public memory? Whatever you think of targeted killing as a tool, the practical challenge is real. You've got analysts who need to stay locked on targets who might be buried in tunnels or living under fake identities in a third country, and the trail gets colder every month.
The thing that makes this different from a regular cold case is the asymmetry of patients. A homicide detective in Chicago has a stack of files and a boss asking about clearance rates. An agency hunting a terrorist has, no, start with the target. The target knows he's on a list. That changes everything about how you pursue him.
Because he's not just hiding from discovery, he's actively countering your search.
Right. He's using couriers instead of phones, he's moving safe houses every few nights, he's got a network of people whose entire job is to tell him if someone's getting close, so the agency can't just be persistent. It has to be more patient than the target is paranoid, and that's a different kind of institutional muscle.
And the public forgets. That's the part Daniel's really asking about. The news cycle moves on, the political pressure dissipates, the budget hearings shift to the next crisis. How do you keep a team funded and focused when nobody's tweeting about it anymore?
There's a structural answer and a psychological one. The structural answer is that these programs get walled off from the normal budget cycle. The Bin Laden hunt operated out of a dedicated unit at CIA. The Alex station, originally, and then evolved into something that reported directly to the top. It wasn't competing with other priorities in the annual appropriations fight. Israel's approach with the October 7th targets appears to follow the same pattern. You create a sealed team, you give it its own funding line, and you don't make it justify its existence every quarter.
Shielded from the bureaucracy.
And the psychological answer is weirder. The people who work these cases long-term aren't motivated by public attention. They're motivated by something closer to, I don't know, craftsmanship. There's a specific kind of analyst who treats an unresolved target file the way a jeweler treats a watch. They know every gear, every scratch, every previous attempt. They've been living with this person's life for years. They know his cousins, his travel patterns, his favorite tea. The file becomes a world.
That's a little unsettling, actually.
It is, but it's also what makes the work possible. You can't sustain a decade-long manhunt on patriotic fervor. That burns out in 6 months. You sustain it because the analyst in room 4 has become the world's leading expert on one specific man and can't stand the idea of leaving the file unresolved.
So it's obsession, institutionalized.
Channeled obsession. And the agencies know this. They select for it. The personality profile that makes someone good at this work overlaps with traits that would be problematic in most other jobs: extreme persistence, high tolerance for frustration, comfort with ambiguity, and a kind of emotional insulation that lets you study a mass murderer's grocery habits for 3 years without burning out.
What about the information decay problem? After year one, you've probably exhausted all the easy leads. Witness memories have degraded. Digital trails have been scrubbed. The target's network has gone dark. What are you actually working with in year 4?
This is where the methodology gets interesting. You shift from active collection to something I'd heard called passive accumulation. You're not running sources against the target anymore because there's nothing to run. Instead, you're monitoring everything around the empty space where the target used to be. You watch his brother's phone, not because the brother will lead you to him, but because eventually the brother will do something that doesn't make sense. A trip to a city he has no reason to visit, a call to a number that shouldn't exist, and that anomaly is your new thread.
The negative space approach.
Yes, you're hunting the silhouette, not the person. And the technology site has transformed this. 20 years ago, you were mostly waiting for a human source to surface. Now you've got signals intelligence that can flag pattern deviations across enormous datasets. A phone number that hasn't been used in 3 years suddenly pings a tower in Beirut. A bank account that's been dormant shows a single small transaction. None of these mean anything individually, but the system is watching for the one combination that does.
How much of this is automated now?
A lot of the triage. The initial flagging. But the synthesis, the moment where an analyst looks at 7 unrelated data points and says, that's him, that's still human. And it probably will be for a long time, because the target is deliberately generating noise, and the machine isn't good at distinguishing noise from signal when the signal is designed to look like noise.
Daniel mentioned the Bin Laden hunt as a reference point. That was what, nearly a decade?
The September 11th attacks were 2001. The raid was May 2011, so 9 years and 8 months. And for most of that time, the trail was ice cold. There was a period in the mid-2000s where the CIA's best lead was literally, he's somewhere in the tribal areas of Pakistan, which is like saying he's somewhere in Western Europe. The breakthrough came from a very old-school method. They identified his courier, a man using the name Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti, and then spent years tracking the courier rather than the target.
Because the courier had to move.
Because the courier had to move. Bin Laden had no internet, no phone, never left the compound. He was a black hole. But someone had to carry messages out, and that person had to exist in the world. The courier made a phone call to someone who was being monitored, and that one call, after years of nothing, was the thread.
And the courier's identity came from detainee interrogations, which opens up a whole separate conversation about methodology.
It does, and that's a real tension in these programs. The most valuable intelligence often comes from methods that are legally and morally fraught. But set that aside for a moment. The operational lesson from Abbottabad is that the pursuit doesn't look like a chase. It looks like a very long period of nothing, punctuated by a single moment of luck that was only possible because someone was still watching.
Israel's October 7th program is different in one obvious way. It's not one target. It's a list.
Right. And the size of the list changes the operational dynamics completely. Bin Laden was a single point of failure for the organization. Get him, and the mission is accomplished. A list of hundreds of targets means you're running a portfolio. Some are high value and get dedicated teams. Some are lower priority and sit in a queue. You're constantly triaging, constantly re-ranking based on new intelligence about who's still operationally dangerous versus who's just in hiding.
And some of them are already dead, and you just don't know it yet.
That's a real problem. You can spend 2 years hunting a man who died in an airstrike you didn't know about, or of natural causes in a tunnel. Confirmation is hard when the target's entire existence is designed to be unconfirmable. So part of the program's work is simply eliminating names from the list, proving a negative.
How do you prove someone's dead if you can't find the body?
You look for the absence of the things that would be present if they were alive. Does their network still behave as though someone is giving orders? Does their family still receive money? Has anyone in the organization used their name or invoked their authority? It's a mosaic of negative indicators, and at some threshold, you make a probabilistic assessment and close the file. But that's uncomfortable for an organization that prides itself on certainty.
The other thing Daniel's question implies is that public memory matters. When the world is watching, you have political cover and resources. When the world moves on, you're operating in the dark. Does that actually affect the work?
It affects the work in ways that are mostly bad, and one way that's unexpectedly useful. The bad ways are obvious. Budget pressure, competing priorities, the difficulty of recruiting sources when the cause feels less urgent. But the useful part is that the target's vigilance also drops. When the news cycle moves on, the target starts to believe he's been forgotten. He gets a little less careful. The safe house routine slips. He uses a phone for 30 seconds. And that's often when he gets caught.
The hunter relies on the prey getting comfortable.
Yes, and the agencies know this. Part of the long game strategy is deliberately lowering the operational tempo to create the impression that the hunt is over. You pull back visible assets. You stop the drone patrols over certain areas. You let the target's network report back that things have gone quiet. And then you wait.
That requires a level of institutional discipline that's rare. Most organizations want to show results.
Most organizations have quarterly earnings calls. Intelligence agencies don't, or at least the parts that do this work don't. The Mossad's operational doctrine has historically been willing to play very long games. There are cases where they tracked Nazi war criminals for decades. Adolf Eichmann was captured in 1960, 15 years after the war ended. The team that found him in Argentina had been working leads that entire time, through multiple changes of government, through periods where nobody in the political leadership was asking about it.
Eichmann's an interesting parallel because that wasn't just intelligence work. It was a political decision to keep the program alive when there was no obvious operational payoff on the horizon.
And that's the part that doesn't get discussed enough. These programs survive because someone at a high level makes a non-rational commitment to them. The cost-benefit analysis of hunting a single man for 15 years doesn't make sense on paper. You could have run 100 other operations with those resources. The commitment is ideological, or moral, or personal. It's not managerial.
Which is why the October 7th program got announced publicly. That's not just operational signaling. That's a promise.
It's a promise to the domestic audience, and it's a message to the targets, and it's also a way of locking in the commitment. Once the Prime Minister says publicly that there's a formal program to hunt down every participant, canceling it becomes politically expensive. The announcement is a ratchet. It makes the program harder to kill than it'd be if it stayed classified.
So the public announcement is itself an institutional tool for maintaining focus.
Yes, it's a commitment device, and it's one that works even if the public stops paying attention, because the political class remembers what was promised, and the opposition will absolutely use a canceled manhunt as a weapon in the next election.
Let me push on something. You said earlier that the analyst who works these cases develops an almost obsessive relationship with the target file. That's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Obsession can produce tunnel vision. You can get so invested in your theory of the case that you miss evidence that contradicts it.
And the agencies have mechanisms for this. Red teams, periodic outside reviews, mandatory rotation of some personnel. But the rotation is tricky because you lose the deep expertise. The ideal is to keep the lead analyst but cycle the support team, so there's always fresh eyes on the material without losing the institutional memory.
Does that actually work in practice?
It works unevenly. There are famous failures where a team got locked into a bad assumption and chased it for years. The hunt for the DC sniper in 2002 had elements of this. They were looking for a white man in a white van because that's what the profile said, and the actual shooters were two black men in a blue Caprice. The profile blinded them to the evidence.
Different kind of case, but the cognitive error is the same.
Same error. And in a long-duration manhunt, the error can persist for much longer because there's no rapid feedback. If you're wrong about the target's location, you might not find out for 5 years. So the institutional safeguards have to be robust, not just procedural checkboxes.
What about the inter-agency dimension? Daniel's prompt mentions Israel, but these hunts almost never stay within one agency's jurisdiction. Bin Laden involves CIA, NSA, JSOC, Pakistani, Isai in complicated ways. The October 7th targets are scattered across Gaza, Lebanon, probably Iran, maybe Turkey.
The coordination problem is enormous. Every agency has its own priorities, its own sources, its own classification rules. Sharing intelligence across agencies is technically and politically difficult even among allies. When you're talking about operations in multiple sovereign territories, some of which are hostile, it gets exponentially harder.
And you can't just send a team into downtown Beirut because you got a lead.
Well, you can, but the diplomatic fallout is severe. So most of these operations involve a mix of unilateral action where you have the capability and the risk is acceptable, and partnered action where you work with a host government services. The partnered approach is slower and leakier but provides political cover.
Israel's approach has historically been more unilateral than most.
It has, and that's partly doctrine and partly necessity. The number of countries that would willingly host an Israeli targeted killing operation on their soil is approximately zero. So the default assumption is that you're going in without permission, which means the operational planning has to account for extraction, deniability, and the possibility of things going very wrong.
The operational tempo on the October 7th program has been relatively high, hasn't it? We've seen confirmed strikes on senior figures in multiple countries over the past couple of years.
Yes, and that's an interesting departure from the classic long game model. They're not waiting a decade. They're pursuing actively, sometimes within months of locating a target. That suggests a few things. 1. The intelligence picture is unusually rich. They're getting actionable information faster than historical norms would predict. 2. The political authorization for rapid action is in place and isn't being second-guessed. And 3. They're willing to accept higher operational risk in exchange for speed.
Because speed denies the target time to relocate.
And because speed has a deterrent effect. If the message is, "We'll find you within 6 months," that's a different message than "We'll find you eventually, maybe in a decade." The psychological impact on the remaining targets is part of the operational calculus.
Let's talk about the information sources that sustain these hunts over time. You mentioned signals intelligence and human sources. What about the forensic trail from October 7th itself?
That's a huge piece of the initial target package. The attacks generated an enormous amount of digital evidence. Body cameras from the attackers, phones from victims, CCTV from the border communities, satellite imagery, intercepted communications. Israeli intelligence reportedly built dossiers on individual participants using that material, identifying specific people from video footage, cross-referencing with existing databases, building out network maps of who was connected to whom.
But that's all from the event itself. That's the starting point, not the sustaining mechanism.
Right. The forensic material gives you the target list. It doesn't tell you where they are now. For that, you need ongoing collection, and the collection methods have to evolve as the targets adapt. Early on, you might get location data from a phone. Later, the target stops using phones, so you shift to financial tracking, or you try to penetrate the courier network, or you exploit the fact that even the most careful target eventually needs medical care, or documents, or money.
Every human need is a vulnerability.
Every single one. And the longer the hunt goes on, the more these small vulnerabilities accumulate. The target needs a fake passport. Someone has to produce that passport. That person has other clients. One of those clients gets caught and provides information. It's a web of indirect connections, and the art of the long-duration manhunt is mapping that web and waiting for the one node that moves.
You mentioned medical care. That's an interesting one.
It's a classic vulnerability. Even the most dedicated terrorist gets sick, or gets injured, or needs dental work. And medical care leaves traces, prescriptions, appointments, specialists. If you know the target has a specific chronic condition, you can monitor pharmacies in the regions where you think he might be. It sounds like something out of a novel, but it's real operational practice.
It's also deeply creepy, in a way that I think is worth sitting with for a second. The idea that somewhere there's an analyst whose job is to know that a specific man has diabetes and is probably running low on insulin.
The intimacy of surveillance is uncomfortable. These programs involve knowing the target's health, his family relationships, his psychological state, his daily routines, often in more detail than his own family knows. That's not a moral judgment, it's just a description of what the work actually is. And it's one of the reasons the analysts who do this have to be carefully selected and monitored. You can't immerse someone in that level of intimate knowledge about another human being, even a monster, without it having psychological effects.
Is there any actual research on that? On the psychological toll of long-duration target tracking?
Not much that's public, for obvious reasons. The agencies study it internally, but they don't publish. What we know anecdotally is that burnout is common, compartmentalization is essential, and the people who last longest tend to be the ones who can treat it as an intellectual puzzle rather than an emotional mission. The ones who get angry burn out. The ones who get curious last.
That's a fascinating distinction. The anger is motivating in the short term, but corrosive over time.
Yes. And the agencies have learned this the hard way. The early years of the post-9/11 manhunts were fueled by a lot of raw emotion, and the attrition rate among analysts was high. Over time, the selection process shifted toward people who could maintain clinical detachment, which creates its own weird dynamic. You've got people who are extremely calm about tracking terrorists, and the calmness itself can look disturbing from the outside.
The professionalism of the thing can seem almost sociopathic if you don't understand the context.
And that's a real public communications challenge for these agencies. When a strike happens and the spokesperson says, "We've been tracking this individual for 4 years," the public reaction is often, "Why did it take so long?" rather than, "Wow, you maintained focus for 4 years." The patience that makes the operation possible is invisible to the audience.
Which brings us back to Daniel's question about public memory. The public doesn't see the work, so the public doesn't value the work, so the political support for the work has to come from somewhere else.
It comes from the top. These programs survive because a small number of very senior people decide they matter and protect them from the normal forces that kill long-term projects. That's the real secret. It's not the technology, it's not the methodology. It's the political will to keep the lights on in a room where nothing visible has happened for 3 years.
And that will is itself a statement about what kind of institution you want to be.
Yes. It says, we're the kind of institution that finishes what it starts, even when nobody is watching. That's a cultural claim as much as an operational one. The other thing that keeps these programs alive is institutional memory. Not just files and databases, but the human memory of the people who were there at the start. On a long manhunt, you inevitably have personnel turnover. People retire, transfer, get promoted. If you don't manage the handoff carefully, you lose the tacit knowledge that isn't written down anywhere.
The stuff that lives in someone's head about why a particular lead was abandoned, or what a source's body language meant during a debriefing.
The written record captures what happened. It doesn't capture why, or what almost happened, or what the analyst's gut said about a particular piece of information. So the best programs have overlapping tours. The outgoing analyst spends months walking the incoming analyst through the file, not just handing over a stack of documents.
That sounds expensive and inefficient.
It's extremely inefficient, and it's the only way that works. The Bin Laden unit had people who stayed on the target for 5, 6, 7 years, and when they finally rotated out, the handoff period was measured in months, not days.
What happens when the target is killed? You've spent 7 years thinking about one man every day. Then one morning you get word that the strike was successful. What's the psychological aftermath for the team?
I've read accounts from people who were in the room for the Bin Laden raid. The dominant emotion wasn't celebration. It was emptiness. The organizing principle of your professional life is suddenly gone. Some people described it as grief, which sounds strange given who the target was, but it makes sense psychologically. You've lost the thing that gave your work meaning.
The hunt structures your identity.
Yes, and the agencies know this too. There are protocols for post-mission decompression, mandatory leave, counseling. Some analysts are reassigned to a completely different domain so they're not immediately thrown into another manhunt. It's treated as a significant psychological event, not just an operational milestone.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about the list. If you've got hundreds of targets, you're not just hunting individuals, you're managing a portfolio. How do you prioritize?
Multiple axes. Operational threat level is the obvious one. Is this person still actively planning or directing attacks? Seniority is another. The planners and commanders rank higher than the foot soldiers. Accessibility is a third. A medium priority target you can reach now might get action before a high priority target who's buried too deep. And then there's a symbolic dimension. Some targets matter more to the organization's morale or to the public's sense of justice, and that factors into the ranking.
So it's a matrix, not a list.
It's a constantly updating matrix, and the update cycle is its own challenge. New intelligence comes in that reshuffles the priorities. A target who was low priority yesterday becomes high priority today because you just learned he's planning something. The team that manages the matrix has to be comfortable with constant reprioritization, which is another personality trait that's not universally distributed.
How does the October 7th program compare to historical precedents in terms of scale?
The scale is unusual. Operation Wrath of God, after the Munich massacre in 1972, targeted a couple of dozen individuals associated with Black September. The post-9/11 hunt was primarily about Bin Laden and a handful of senior Al-Qaeda figures. The October 7th program is reportedly targeting hundreds, possibly over 1,000 individuals, which makes it more like a decentralized counterterrorism campaign than a traditional targeted killing program.
Which changes the resource equation dramatically.
Massively. You can't run 1,000 simultaneous manhunts with the level of attention we've been describing, so there's a tiered approach. The top tier gets the full treatment. Dedicated teams, deep dossiers, continuous collection. The middle tier gets periodic review and opportunistic action. The bottom tier is essentially on a watch list. If they surface, you'll act, but you're not actively hunting them.
And the tiers shift as people move up or down in priority.
constantly. It's a living system, and the system itself requires maintenance. The database, the analytical tools, the interagency coordination mechanisms. You're not just running operations, you're running the platform that enables operations.
One last thing before we move on. You mentioned the forensic evidence from October 7th as the starting point. How long does that evidence remain useful?
The video and photographic evidence is timeless. You can always go back to it. But the signals intelligence has a shelf life. Phone numbers get abandoned, email accounts go dark, IP addresses change. The first 6 months after the event are the richest period for signals intelligence. After that, you're increasingly reliant on human sources and on the slow accumulation of indirect indicators we talked about.
So the methodology shifts over the life of the program.
Phase one is exploitation of the event itself. All the forensic material, the initial interrogations, the flood of signals intelligence from the immediate aftermath. Phase two is active pursuit, running sources, tracking leads, conducting operations against accessible targets. Phase three is the long game, passive accumulation, network analysis, waiting for the target to make a mistake. Most programs spend most of their time in phase three.
And phase three is the one that's hardest to fund and hardest to staff.
Because it's boring. It's boring on purpose. And the skill of doing boring work well for years without losing focus, that's the core competency of a long-duration manhunt. It's not glamorous. It's not cinematic. It's mostly people in rooms looking at spreadsheets and waiting for a single cell to change.
The most traumatic moment in the Bin Laden hunt, the Abbottabad raid, was 72 minutes long. The hunt was 9 years.
That ratio tells you everything about what this work actually is.
They're right.
Sorry?
What you said about the spreadsheets. I've been doing it for 11 years.
Doing what?
Watching a list. Not terrorists. Domain names. There's a set of about 40 domains that were used in a phishing campaign against my old employer in 2014. I still check them every week.
Every week for 11 years.
Monday mornings. Takes about 20 minutes. I've got a script that pings the DNS records and flags anything that changes. Most weeks, nothing changes. Some weeks, the domain expires and I watch to see if anyone re-registers it. Twice, someone did. Both times, it was nothing. Domain squatters. But I kept watching.
What are you looking for?
The campaign used lookalike domains. You register something that's one letter off from the real domain and you wait. The attackers ran the campaign, took what they could get, and moved on. But I figured, they still own the domains. Maybe they come back. Maybe they use the same infrastructure for something else. Maybe they sell the domain list to another group. You don't know until you watch.
And your employer was fine with this?
I never told them. It's not part of my job. I just wanted to see how the story ended.
11 years of Monday mornings.
I missed 3 weeks in 2019 when I had shingles. Other than that, the setup's a mess. The script runs on an old laptop under my desk that I have to restart every couple of months because the fan gets stuck. The output goes to a text file that I read manually. I keep meaning to set up alerts properly, but I never get around to it.
What would make you stop?
I don't know. I suppose if all the domains finally dropped and stayed dropped for a full year. That hasn't happened yet. There's always three or four that someone keeps renewing. Probably automated. Probably means nothing. But I'd rather be wrong about that and have wasted 11 years of Mondays than be right and not be watching.
That's exactly the psychology you're describing. The unwillingness to close the file.
It is. And the thing is, Hilbert's approach isn't irrational. The cost of watching is low, 20 minutes a week. The cost of missing the one event that matters is potentially catastrophic. The asymmetry makes the persistence logical, even if the odds are terrible.
The odds are terrible. I know that. I still check.
What was the employer?
Small credit union in Connecticut. They got bought out in 2018. The new owners don't even use the old domain anymore. But the attackers don't know that.
So you're protecting an entity that no longer exists against a threat that probably no longer exists, using a laptop with a bad fan.
When you say it like that, it sounds foolish.
It doesn't sound foolish. It sounds like the thing we've been talking about for 20 minutes.
The file on my desk says the domains are still registered. Until that changes, the file's still open.
The cutting room floor detail I wanted to mention. The Eichmann operation had a false start in 1958. Mossad got a tip he was in Argentina, sent a team, spent weeks surveilling the wrong man. They pulled back, re-verified, and didn't get him for another 2 years. Even the successes are full of dead ends.
Which is why the institutional commitment matters more than any single lead. The leads will fail. The commitment has to survive the failures.
The question Daniel's really asking, I think, is whether justice has a shelf life. And the answer these programs give is, not if you refuse to put one on it.
That's the thing. It's a choice. It's always a choice. The technology helps, the methodology helps, but at the bottom it's an institution deciding that some files don't get closed until the person in the file is dead.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and for the DNS surveillance operation we apparently didn't know about.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find every episode at myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.